Good morning. It's the 7th of July, Tuesday, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Changing face of war poses new tests for military powers. Jet fuel costs drop, brings no relief for flyers. And founder plots return to Davos Forum. Our first article by Yaroslav Trofimov. Changing face of war poses new tests for military powers. Flexibility is key as drones, AI, and cheap missiles upend how battles are waged. The way wars are fought is changing fast as new technologies upend military doctrines on everything from procurement to executing operations. Just how radical will this transformation be in years to come, and are the hundreds of billions of dollars being invested by the U.S., its allies and rivals in new tanks, planes, and warships going to become the equivalent of buying horses and arrows on the eve of machine guns and howitzers? The war between Russia and Ukraine was initially dismissed by many Western military leaders as a conflict that didn't hold many lessons for them because the U.S. and allies, should they fight, would have air superiority and powerful precision munitions for a quick, devastating blow. The failure of the U.S. and Israel to inflict a strategic defeat on a middle power like Iran after expending a large share of these precision munitions has undermined that notion. Drone-centered warfare, and with it, the accessibility of abundant, cheap precision munitions is here to stay. So is the spread of other capabilities, such as long-range ballistic and cruise missiles that used to be the preserve of major powers, and even for them were too expensive for mass use. Meanwhile, the development of autonomous systems guided by artificial intelligence heralds an even more momentous turn. In the wars of today, what used to be the safe rear, hundreds of miles away from the front line, is now contested, be it at U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf or Russian military installations far from Ukraine. The proliferation of cheap sensors has also made any massed maneuver, such as an armored thrust, akin to the U.S. assault on Iraq in 2003, much more difficult because any concentration of troops can be spotted quickly and attacked well before reaching the battlefield. In defense ministries and military headquarters around the world, everyone is paying attention and trying to figure out what lessons to draw. The character of warfare is changing fundamentally, said General Carsten Brewer, Germany's chief of defense. Armed forces must be able to adapt faster, integrate new technologies, and learn at speed. If we fail to adapt, we will not be able to prevail. His Dutch counterpart, General Onno Eichelsheim, sounded a similar alarm. Technology will change quite fast when you're at war, he said. If we do not change ourselves to adaptability and flexibility, then we will lose the first weeks of the war, too much ground and too many people, and then we will adapt. But it will be too late. Military leaders, governments, and defense companies disagree on whether to call the current developments a revolution that warrants a complete overhaul of existing doctrines. Revolution or not, so few doubt that the way of waging war is experiencing rapid and accelerating change. Autonomy using AI has already become a major enabler for the U.S. in its creation of target lists for the air war against Iran. Autonomous Ukrainian-operated drones, including those supplied by German manufacturer Helsing, patrol the highways of occupied southern Ukraine looking for targets like fuel trucks using AI pattern recognition and then pursuing them on their own once authorized by a human operator. For similar missions, Russia has begun using AI-guided Molniya drones that don't have a human in the loop because Russian forces lack access to Starlink for guidance. Autonomy is just starting to hit the battlefield now, but it will be the bigger game changer over the next 5 to 10 years because it's all-encompassing and fundamentally changes what used to be a human-centric battlefield, said Gunbert Scherf, Helsing's co-CEO. Louis Mosley, head of the UK and Europe operations for Palantir, a U.S. defense company that was heavily involved in the war on Iran and provides key support for Ukraine's campaign against Russia, said this year is likely to mark an historic pivot. I wouldn't be surprised if 2026 is remembered for centuries to come as a year in which a major breakthrough in military technology was made, akin to gunpowder and the like, which is autonomy, he said. The key feature of the war between Russia and Ukraine, and likely of other major conflicts to come, is that what used to be cutting-edge weapons and technologies becomes outdated within months. If you have an adaptive adversary, it's the speed of iteration and the rate of learning that matter rather than the technology per se, Mosley added. One example of adaptability is Ukraine's new procurement system for drones, which account for over 90% of enemy losses, electronic warfare systems, and some other key weapons. It is fundamentally different from how Western militaries, with their centralized defense budgets, operate. Under a system introduced last August, Ukrainian brigades are allocated E-points based on how many Russian soldiers and pieces of equipment they successfully hit, with drones providing video footage as proof of these engagements. Converting these E-points into money via the country's Delta Battlefield Management Network, brigades can then quickly purchase new systems directly from manufacturers through a classified online marketplace. As direct relationships develop, the weapon becomes, in a way, a subscription service rather than an object, constantly updated and redesigned to fit changing battlefield conditions. Drone warfare has also upended basic notions such as air superiority. The U.S. could have full control of the Iranian skies with the ultra-modern aircraft like the F-35, and yet it couldn't protect its key bases and installations in the Persian Gulf from Iranian drone and missiles in March and April. Instead of treating drones as yet another weapon within the existing military structure, Ukraine has recognized drone warfare as a separate domain. The domain is time. The point is to shorten the kill chain, removing human and manual steps, which means that on every turn, you get to the kill decision and kill execution faster than your enemy, said Oleg Reginsky, CEO of UForce, a maker of naval and air drones. Ukraine's fast-paced and innovative approach is hard to replicate for countries not actually involved in wars and therefore not expending large amounts of munitions that need to be replaced. If we in Europe decide to start manufacturing millions of short-range drones of the kind they make in Ukraine, it ain't months, they'll all become obsolete. What shall we do with them? Wondered Mario Gilli, professor of military strategy and technology at the Hertie School in Berlin. In this environment, the ability to rapidly change alongside technology becomes a crucial component of defense. To keep up, defense manufacturers and military commanders alike have to rethink how they operate and what part of the traditional equipment and doctrine fits in the new way of war. It's still an evolution, but iterations, thanks to technology development, are going so fast that it may be misinterpreted as a revolutionary approach, said General Michael Claesson, Sweden's chief of defense. We're not done with legacy, and the legacy will have to follow us, partially, into the future. What kind of legacy is the question? The problem for military commanders is that, even as they seek to adapt to the war of the future, they still need to consider the threats that exist today. For German and other European armed forces, it is first and foremost the possibility of a conflict with Russia. Transformation can't mean putting readiness on hold, General Brewer said, and Germany must modernize its armed forces while maintaining the fight-tonight capabilities necessary to defend Europe. We cannot pause deterrence and tell the adversary to come back in 2039. And that's Challenging Face of War poses new tests for military powers. Our next headline, jet fuel costs drop brings no relief for flyers. Carriers aren't rushing to bring back flights trimmed during oil's surge. This is my Allison Sider. Airlines are finally getting some relief as the jet fuel pump. Flyers may not share in the savings, though. Jet fuel prices doubled in the weeks after the Iran war started, and carriers raised fares to keep up. Now fuel prices are down 40% from their peak in April, but analysts say fares aren't likely to follow because travelers keep paying up. Resilient travel demand and restrained supply, especially with the one-time discount leader Spirit Airlines out of the picture, are bolstering airline executives' confidence. I'm actually very bullish that the industry will retain a much higher percent of the fare increases than would be typical historically, Southwest Airlines Chief Executive Bob Jordan said at an investor conference in late May. Obviously, you hate to see somebody go out of business, but with Spirit out of business, I think that helps the environment, he said. Airline shares have been on a tear in recent weeks, trading higher with each downward move in the price of crude oil. Delta Airlines, the industry's profit leader, and United Airlines both hit record highs in late June. American Airlines stock rose more than 30% over the last month. Carriers have cranked up fares 8 times since the start of the war, according to Deutsche Bank analysts. In May, the average price of a round-trip domestic ticket sold through a travel agency was $628, up nearly $100 from a year earlier, according to Airlines Reporting Corporation, which tracks agency ticket sales. But executives have said, somewhat to their surprise, bookings haven't slowed. I have expected more of an elasticity effect, United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby said in May, but the demand environment is pretty strong. The supply of seats in the market has also tightened. Airlines dropped flights and weren't going to make enough money to be worthwhile at higher fuel prices. Before the Iran war began, U.S. carriers were planning to boost domestic schedules by 4.6% in the third quarter, compared with the same period of 2025, according to schedule data analyzed by trade group Airlines for America. Now they're hardly planning to grow at all. Spirited away. In the past, such periods usually didn't last long. When fuel prices fell, carriers would eventually start adding flights and routes again to capture more revenue. But the budget airlines that once spurred the rest of the industry to race to the bottom on ticket prices are trying to stem their own losses. They can no longer afford to expand at the same breakneck pace they once did. Spirit Airlines, once the most prominent and disruptive of the discounters, shut down in May when the surge in fuel prices helped knock the bankrupt carrier from its already precarious perch. For American, let's face it, we competed with Spirit across the board, American CEO Robert Isom said in May. While Spirit had shrunk to a fraction of its former size by the time it shuttered, we saw across-the-board improvements in all those places that we compete directly, he said. There are some routes, like Atlanta to Fort Lauderdale and Orlando, where rivals have rushed to fill the gap Spirit left behind, leading to lower fares, according to data provider OAG. Still, the months of skyrocketing fuel prices will likely dent airline profits this year. Carriers are due to report second quarter results in the coming weeks, starting with Delta on Friday. Initially, airlines were only covering a portion of the run-up through higher fares, but that started to change as fuel prices receded. The tickets we're selling today are probably covering the spot price of fuel in their entirety, Alaska Airlines Chief Financial Officer Shane Tackett said in early June. Playing catch-up. Airline executives have said the increase in fares is long overdue and that travel remains a good deal, even at current prices. Fares didn't rise in price the way other goods did in recent years. The consumer price index for airfare fell 3.5% from 2019 to 2025, while overall consumer prices rose 26%. But consumers, weary of paying high prices for just about everything, may not see it that way much longer. Their thinking about travel spending has shifted since the start of the year, with an uptick in the share of Americans saying it's a bad time to spend on vacations, according to a survey conducted by market research firm Future Partners. Some consumers say they're already tightening their belts. While few were willing to give up a summer trip, even if it was a bit more expensive, consumers might start rethinking their plans in the fall, Melius research analyst Connor Cunningham wrote last week. The real test is what happens after Labor Day, when leisure demand tapers and airlines adjust fall capacity for a lower fuel environment, Cunningham wrote. If demand moderates even at the margin, or if supply is added back too quickly, the old addiction to fair sales and discounting could return. That's jet fuel cost drop brings no relief for flyers. Next, we have Founder Plot's return to Davos Forum. This is by Emily Glazer. Klaus Schwab is trying to make a comeback at the World Economic Forum. The 88-year-old founder recently sent letters to board members with a list of demands, legal threats, and a request for an advisory role that would give him a say in appointing the forum's future leadership, according to documents viewed by the Wall Street Journal. Schwab resigned as chair of the forum, which hosts an annual meeting in January in Davos, Switzerland, last year after a public clash with the board for its opening of an investigation into a whistleblower's allegations of misconduct. A journal investigation in 2024 uncovered evidence of a toxic culture at the forum for women and black employees. Schwab denied any wrongdoing. Schwab's justification is anchored in part on the forum last year saying it found no material wrongdoing in a public statement after the investigation into the complaints of unauthorized spending and inappropriate treatment of female staffers. Documents reviewed by the journal show that the August 2025 statement was at odds with findings that were privately shared with the board by lawyers conducting the probe. Those included instances of discrimination and bullying, misuse of corporate funds, and breaches of data integrity. Schwab asked that some of those significant findings not be made public, a decision some board members didn't agree with, people familiar with the discussions said. Before the August 2025 statement, the journal reported that preliminary findings in the investigation found misconduct over the span of a decade, including improper travel expenses and gifts. The findings also included bullying behavior and inappropriate treatment of female staffers, the journal reported. Now Schwab is seeking to regain access to forum premises and communications channels, as well as farewell visits for him and his wife, Hilde Schwab, to the forum's overseas locations, according to the documents. He's also asking the forum to reinstate personal security for him and cover at least half of his personal legal costs related to the dispute. Schwab's recent correspondence lambastes the forum's board for deploying money and using advisors to diminish his legacy. The correspondence threatens legal action against the forum's trustees. The board, which is co-chaired by BlackRock chief executive Larry Fink and Roche Vice Chairman Andre Hoffman, is slated to meet in mid-August. They took over on an interim basis in August 2025 when the board's interim chairman, Peter Brabeck-Letmathe, a former CEO of Nestle, resigned. He had raised concerns about a toxic work environment, the journal previously reported. The forum didn't respond to questions about Schwab's latest demands. The forum said it held successful meetings this year, and as we look ahead, we remain focused on ensuring the forum continues to provide a unique platform for global collaboration. Schwab didn't respond to requests for comment. The forum struck exit agreements last year with Schwab and his wife. The forum's board approved a pension payment equivalent to about $7 million split into cash installments in December 2025 and December 2026, in addition to a typical Swiss pension, according to documents viewed by the journal. The payout included a separate payment equivalent to about $200,000 to clear the couple out of the forum offices and fund a private executive assistant at their personal residence. In exchange for the payments in Swiss francs, Schwab agreed to no longer take an active role in the forum, according to the documents. And that's Founder Plot's return to Davos Forum. Our next article is by Rebecca Picciotto and Nicholas G. Miller. Moving in, kids in 20s are living back home. Samantha Stobo was fresh off a breakup and unable to afford her Manhattan two-bedroom alone. So, the 29-year-old decided to move in with her mom in Miami until she could get back on her feet. She told herself it would only take a few months. Now, 33 years old, Stobo has no plans to move out. "I thought it was going to be temporary," Stobo said, "but it's been 3 years now, and I love it." Living at home as a 20-something was once viewed as a failure to launch and even a source of embarrassment. That's no longer the case, as it is now often viewed as a sign of financial prudence and, for some, a long-term prospect. Chronically high living costs are helping reshape the milestones of early adulthood in America. The national median home price hovers above $400,000. Rents are at record highs in cities across the U.S., and many recent college graduates are settled with tens of thousands of dollars in student debt. Even though some of these young adults pay their folks' rent, it tends to be well below the cost of living on their own. "Everything is just out of reach," said 28-year-old Megan Talley, who lives at home with her mom in the Atlanta suburbs. "If a young person wants to live alone, you could do it, but you'd be dead broke at the end of the month." Last year, 49% of adults under age 30 said they lived with a parent, up 12 percentage points from 2019, according to the Federal Reserve's latest survey of household economics and decision-making. Nearly a third of those adults were 25 or older. Some economists put that figure lower and note that the Fed study doesn't distinguish between children living in their parents' homes versus parents living in their children's homes. Still, young people say that living at home in 2026 doesn't carry the stigma it once did. About 55% of young adults who moved back home said it was out of financial necessity, according to a spring survey by financial services firm Thrivent. So many parents and adult children are living together now that it's beginning to transform aspects of American society, from when members of the younger generation start a family to the way builders think about designing homes. Far from hiding it, some now broadcast their lives as stay-at-home daughters or stay-at-home sons on social media. Stobo says posting about her mother-daughter living situation on TikTok has earned her a friendly comment section filled with others in the same position and makes her some money. "No one ever judges me," she said. The conversation tends to be more like, "That's awesome, and I bet you're saving money." Casey Wright, 28, moved back home to Oxford, Michigan 3 years ago after being laid off from two consecutive jobs. She redecorated her childhood bedroom to match her adult aesthetic, tearing down her Twilight posters and choir awards and hanging a floral tapestry and framed landscapes. She and her parents have come to an agreement on living together as adults. She no longer has a curfew, though before she goes out, Wright's parents require her to tell them where she's going and what time she expects to be back. The Wrights have dinner together every night and go golfing or walking together a few times a month. Casey still hangs out in her parents' room occasionally to talk about movies with her dad or to gossip with her mom. She just doesn't spend time with her parents quite as often as she did when she was a child and is more often in her room playing video games or reading. "It's not as much as when I was younger because I feel like there's almost that separation that's needed as an adult," she said. "You're not just living in your childhood home as a child." Multi-generational living has long been more of a norm among Hispanic, Asian, and Black households, along with immigrant families. During the pandemic, a broader swath of 20-somethings returned home. It was supposed to be short-term, then came record inflation and double-digit rent increases. By July 2020, 52% of young Americans aged 18 to 29 lived with at least one parent, according to a Pew Research Center analysis of census data. It was the first time a majority of young adults in the country had lived with parents since the Great Depression. That share has likely dropped since then, but for some people, the arrangements have stuck. Living with parents became a dominant living arrangement in America for people in this age group, said Lawrence Steinberg, a Temple University psychology professor who recently wrote the book, You and Your Adult Child. States such as California and New York have loosened regulations around building accessory dwelling units in recent years. once nicknamed Granny Flats, ADUs are now used to house budget-squeezed adult children. Villa Homes, a California home builder, is used to this kind of customer. The firm is seeing more families adding detached ADUs for their grown children or other relatives to live in for a few years and save money for a starter home. Carmen Johnson, 33, has loved living with her parents in the Detroit metro area since the start of COVID. She doesn't pay rent, splits grocery bills with her family, and invests those savings in her music career and toward a future home. Beats barely making ends meet in her old Los Angeles apartment. COVID flipped the script, Johnson said. It's a blessing in disguise. She isn't ashamed of living at home and doesn't judge other people for it either. But she wouldn't necessarily reveal it to a first date unless asked directly. Bringing home a date also requires a bit of mental calculus. It's like, okay, is my dad going to be in the living room watching TV? Johnson said. Sometimes that kind of strategizing goes both ways. Jessica Suzio, a 52-year-old widow in Michigan, has tried to get back into the dating scene in recent years, but with her two sons living at home, both in their mid-20s, bringing back a new boyfriend is uncomfortable for all involved, she said. Suzio is happy to have her sons at home, and they help with household expenses by paying her some rent. When they were younger, I was daydreaming about the days I'd be an empty nester, she said, but I've grown to really appreciate them sticking around. Wright, in Michigan, doesn't pay rent, but her father, Craig, said she's been a big help around the house. About five times a day, Casey says her mom knocks on her door, often to ask for help with technology. If I had the ability to, I'd move out tomorrow, Wright said. Nothing against her parents, I just love to have the freedom to do what they were doing at my age. Wright's father wishes the same for his daughter. He and his wife expected to have an empty nest by now, but he realizes that the housing market is different today than when he was in his 30s in the 1980s and bought a three-bedroom home for $70,000, less than a fifth of today's median home price. He estimates his salary back then was about $35,000. Some of Craig's friends also have adult children living at home. It's kind of normal, he said. And that's moving in. Kids in 20s are living back home. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website. And that's at sunsounds.org. Or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. And that app is available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad. Or you can get it from the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot Echo or Show. Well, let's move on to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Microsoft slashes 3,000 Xbox jobs. Big banks weigh deal to avoid debit card fee limits. And Krispy Kreme still needs a human touch. First, we have Microsoft slashes 3,000 Xbox jobs, video game units subscriptions are below expectations, and revenue is down. This is by Ben Fritz. Microsoft will cut some 3,200 jobs from its Xbox video games division as it restructures the struggling business. The company will lay off 1,600 people this week and 1,250 more during the rest of the fiscal year that began this month, Xbox Chief Executive Asha Sharma said in a memo to staff Monday. In addition, Microsoft is selling or spinning off four game development studios and exploring strategic options for a fifth, moves that will take at least 350 additional people off its payroll. Those cuts represent about one-fifth of the division's total headcount. Our business today is not healthy, Sharma wrote in her memo. We must reset Xbox. The video game industry has been pummeled by layoffs for the past couple of years after many companies, including Microsoft, expanded aggressively in response to a surge of business during the pandemic. That boom halted when the world reopened. Microsoft bought game production companies, including Activision Blizzard, to beef up the offerings on Game Pass, its Netflix-style subscription service. The company projected Game Pass subscriptions would reach around 77 million this year, according to a document revealed during legal proceedings related to the Activision acquisition. It currently has about 30 million, a person familiar with the matter said. Sharma said in her memo that Game Pass did not grow at the pace we expected. Xbox revenue fell 5% in the quarter ended March from a year earlier. Its profit margin in the fiscal year that ended in June was 3%, a decline from the prior year. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella picked Sharma, a former chief operating officer of Instacart, to run Xbox in February despite her lack of experience in video games. She has quickly begun making drastic changes. Sharma is cutting the number of games Microsoft publishes and is investing more in its most popular franchises, including Minecraft, Candy Crush, and Fallout. She reduced the price of Game Pass, which lost subscribers following an increase last year, and stopped putting new Call of Duty games on the service so gamers would have to buy them. Microsoft has raised prices for its Xbox console because of the worldwide squeeze in memory chips, which has also affected competitors Sony and Nintendo. Xbox operates a digital game store for Windows PCs. As the company makes fewer games of its own, Sharma is trying to make Microsoft a more attractive distributor for the independent game developers. And that's Microsoft slashes 3,000 Xbox jobs. We'll turn now to an article by Gina Hebe and Ben Glickman. Big banks weigh deal to avoid debit card fee limits. Some of the largest banks in the country have been exploring an acquisition that could allow them to get around one of the laws they hate most, the limits on fees they earn on debit card transactions. When Capital One Financial bought Discover Financial in a $50.6 billion deal, it got a network that cut out the need for a middleman in card transactions and allowed it to deal more directly with merchants. Now, big banks are looking on with envy because owning a network can mean exemption from a federal law that caps debit card fees. Those fees collectively amount to billions of dollars each year across the industry, but banks have long complained the government-defined cap limits their ability to offer customers debit card rewards and other services. Some have been exploring a small deal that could upend the rules, though they're worried about political backlash if they try. Big banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and PNC Financial Services Group, have in recent months held preliminary and tentative discussions about a deal to acquire a network owned by the financial technology company Fiserv, according to people familiar with the matter. There's no certainty a deal will happen. Several of the banks that looked at the Fiserv network have already decided it would be unlikely for them to move forward, some of the people said. Some have privately expressed concern that such a deal could prompt backlash from lawmakers, regulators, and merchants, the people added. The talks, even at a preliminary stage, are one more sign of how eager banks are to find an edge in payments wherever they can. The industry is grappling with rapid changes in the space driven by the embrace of crypto and fintechs under the Trump administration. A section within the 2010 Dodd-Frank law called the Durbin Amendment caps fees large banks can collect from merchants on debit card transactions if they're routed through an outside network. But banks would also be exempt from that cap if they own the network, the infrastructure that underpins the transaction. So-called interchange fees are paid by merchants when customers shop with their debit cards and are mostly pocketed by banks and other financial institutions that issue those cards. The Durbin Amendment gave the Federal Reserve the power to set caps for banks and other financial institutions with $10 billion or more in assets. Fees on credit card usage aren't capped by law, though they remain another intense fight. The fee has been part of a battle ever since. Banks have said interchange fee revenue previously helped cover the costs associated with free checking accounts and debit card rewards programs, which have been cut back. Bank of America even briefly threatened to charge $5 a month for debit cards after the rule took effect. Merchants and the law's supporters say lower interchange fees have been passed on to customers and help keep prices down. Fiserv provides financial technology that connects Wall Street to Main Street. It owns two networks that process debit card transactions called Star and Accel. The company has been in turmoil with its stock down roughly 70% from a year ago. And that's Big Bank's way deal to avoid credit card fee limits. Our next item, Krispy Kreme still needs a human touch. This is by Heather Haddon, Elk Grove Village, Illinois. Baking more than a billion donuts a year is no sweat for Krispy Kreme. The company manufactures its own equipment to shape, bake, and glaze the shiny pastries it sells across more than 40 countries and relies on relatively few workers. Cake crumbles, graham cracker crust toppings, and Star Spangled Sprinkles are a whole other challenge. Krispy Kreme has tried donut decorating robots and found they can't beat the human touch. It got super messy, Chief Executive Josh Charlesworth said in an interview at one of the company's production and retail hubs west of Chicago. Offering Instagram-ready Harry Potter, He-Man, and Milk Bar donuts is part of Krispy Kreme's strategy as it seeks to rebound from a challenging 2025. The North Carolina company posted quarterly losses last year as costs rose and some sales didn't yield enough profit, particularly a short-lived partnership with McDonald's. Charlesworth is working on expanding sales through Walmart and other big retailers while increasing efficiency and hiring the human donut artists Krispy Kreme needs to hook customers. The average Krispy Kreme customer only buys its products two or three times a year, and around half of its clientele is under 35. That means making eye-popping, limited-edition donuts that can be social media stars. Krispy Kreme now does 15 to 20 special runs of donuts a year, plus a collection for each season, with staff decorating them by hand. That adds costs, but they boosted sales and are worth the effort, Charlesworth said. Customers queued in long lines to snap up a special edition Harry Potter collection last year, for example. Seeking turnaround, Krispy Kreme's sales have grown since the chain again went public in 2021. Its profits haven't, and since becoming CEO in 2024, it's been Charlesworth's job to change that. The company last year suspended its dividend and laid off corporate staff to reduce costs and chip away at its debt. It terminated unprofitable delivery routes, sold its stake in Insomnia Cookies, and is moving toward more franchised stores. Charlesworth also wants to get more out of Krispy Kreme's donut lines, with the company only tapping around 25% of the capacity of its machines. He's incorporating artificial intelligence into manufacturing processes and using connected technology to troubleshoot machines. Krispy Kreme stock soared in 2022 after it said it would start selling its donuts at U.S. McDonald's locations. Roughly 2.5 years later, both sides called it quits after the deal failed to perform up to expectations. Charlesworth said the deal didn't put Krispy Kreme donuts in front of enough customers to justify the investments in manufacturing and delivery. McDonald's said that Krispy Kreme represented a small part of its breakfast business and that the donuts were profitable for franchisees and the company. Krispy Kreme is having better luck stocking donuts in high-traffic retailers like Walmart, Target, and Kroger, which have displayed its boxes prominently, Charlesworth said. No hit from GLP-1s. Krispy Kreme doesn't think weight loss drugs are hurting business. Charlesworth said customers want a high-quality, craveable donut. GLP-1s are no. Most important thing for us is that they taste great, they look great, and they're fresh, he said. Still, for those with smaller appetites, the company now offers mini donuts, including Mother's Day versions in May. The company has traditionally employed its own drivers to distribute its donuts. Charlesworth said, "That's proven too costly, and the company's now turning to third-party delivery companies to supply grocery and convenience stores. What we do best is making the donuts, serving the donuts," Charlesworth said. "This distribution expertise is best done with partners." And that's Krispy Kreme still needs a human touch. Our next article is by Kwan Wu Jun. Samsung projects huge rise in profit. Samsung Electronics projected a 19-fold surge in second quarter operating profit, signaling that its record earning streak is set to continue amid the artificial intelligence boom and red-hot demand for chips to power AI infrastructure and applications. The strong results from the world's largest memory chip maker are likely to help ease recent market concerns about the sustainability of AI computing capacity spending. Shares in Samsung more than doubled from April to June, only to lose momentum this month as investors' jitters resurfaced. Samsung has extended its run of record quarterly revenue and operating profit since the final quarter of 2025. Its chip-making division is expected to fuel even stronger earnings growth this year, many analysts said, citing booming demand for AI chips. The South Korean technology company said in preliminary earnings report Monday that its operating profit likely reached a record of about 89.4 trillion won, equivalent to $58.47 billion, for the 3 months ended in June. That would be a 56% jump from the previous quarter's record. The projected operating profit also surpassed a FactSet compiled consensus estimate of 85.054 trillion won for the second quarter. Quarterly revenue is forecast to have more than doubled to a record 171 trillion won, Samsung said. Some analysts said that Samsung's operating profit would have topped the estimate had it not booked a provision for special bonuses payable early next year to employees in its chip-making division. Samsung in May agreed to allocate 10.5% of its semiconductor division's annual operating profit to special bonuses, contingent on the company meeting certain profitability benchmarks. Citigroup analyst Peter Lee said that Samsung's recent share price pullback may be a technical correction. The stock surged more than 150% this year, supported by better-than-expected server DRAM chip processing, driven by strong demand for AI central processing units. "We believe memory fundamentals are intact and server DRAM pricing has been outperforming on strong CPU demand," Lee said, raising his 2026 operating profit forecast for Samsung to 401 trillion won from 334 trillion won. And that Samsung projects huge rise in profits. Our next item is by Paul Berger. A Tesla truck rival, wages, rig, go missing. Windrose Technology seemed poised this year to disrupt trucking. $400 million raised to build an electric big rig to rival Tesla's semi-truck. By March, the company was in such disarray that Windrose's chief executive, Wen Han, was demanding to know where one of his $285,000 trucks had gone. Two former employees fired in January, Travis Waite and Harold Keller, refused to help locate the vehicle until Han paid them a combined $91,000 in unpaid wages and benefits. "They still haven't been paid," they say, and the truck remains at large. Han disputed their accounts and said the dollar amounts they claim are unfounded. The standoff highlights the headaches facing Windrose, which was compared with innovators such as Waymo. Yet Han's problems go beyond the cash crunch that many startups face, ex-employees say. The Chinese-owned, Belgian-based company faces unpaid debts, a lawsuit in federal court, and scrutiny from U.S. safety regulators. In interviews with the Wall Street Journal, Han said Windrose had payroll issues, but he said Windrose has sufficient funding as it seeks to expand. He said he was a victim of anti-Chinese animus in the U.S. "My job is to produce a good product, not to make people love me or like me," Han said, adding, "I certainly hired too quickly and too aggressively." Hahn said Windrose secured orders this year for more than 150 trucks in the U.S., Norway, Chile, and Australia, and the company's forging ahead with plants and assembly partners in Europe and the U.S. Hahn said he plans to take Windrose public via a merger with a special purpose acquisition company this year. "This is basically our rookie year when we're really coming out into the market," he said. "We will be profitable by the end of the year." Hahn, a former Chinese autonomous trucking company executive, said he spotted an opportunity as electric vehicles took off in the early 2020s. "I realized there needs to be a better truck," he said. He launched Windrose in 2022, first in China, and then with offices in the U.S. and Belgium. Windrose's first truck, the R700, was on the road in China by the end of 2024. To date, it has 36 trucks deployed worldwide, Hahn said. Windrose's truck has twice as much driving range as one of Daimler or Volvo's electric trucks, charging ports on either side, and a price tag about $100,000 less than other manufacturers. "The technology looks quite amazing," said Yinhao Zhi, a senior researcher at the International Council on Clean Transportation, a research group. "This is a Chinese manufacturer with a very well-integrated supply chain and very good cost competitiveness." Hahn said Windrose's edge includes contract manufacturers that build the trucks in China before shipping them to regional partners for local assembly. It raised capital from venture firms and hedge funds in the U.S. and China. None returned requests for comment. Former employees questioned why he pursued aggressive expansion plans and made outside commitments while struggling to make payroll. "In reality, Windrose was struggling to secure orders in Europe," ex-employees say, while problems were growing. Some workers said they became nervous about demonstrating trucks when they weren't being paid. Corporate charge cards in July ran out of funds. By August, paychecks were still delayed. Last May, operations director Kylie Mackey complained in a company chat about missing wages. By March, labor regulators in Michigan ordered Windrose to pay almost $10,000 in back wages and interest. Hahn said he would pay the money, but disputes the amount involved and may file a counterclaim later. In October, Windrose's then head of North American operations, Jason Geese, demanded missing wages through an attorney. Geese was fired days later, he alleges in a federal lawsuit. In January, a judge ordered the company to pay $413,000 in unpaid wages and severance. Neither Hahn nor Windrose appeared in court for the case. Hahn said he would contest the judgment and claimed Geese was fired for cause. A lawyer for Geese, Michael Pitt, said Geese wasn't fired for cause. He was retaliated against for asking for unpaid wages. Many ex-employees said they asked a similar question. If Windrose raised so much capital, where did it all go? Hahn said he was always clear about the company's finances. "I'm definitely at fault for being too optimistic, but that's the common shortage," his word, "of an entrepreneur," he said. In a previous interview, Hahn said he raised $400 million. More recently, he said has $100 million in equity and $200 million in lines of credit. He said he's in the process of raising a further $100 million in equity. "The key is not to have a huge cash balance in the bank, but to use the cash well, as we have, and reach profitability as a company, so that you're generating cash versus having to save cash," Hahn said. Meanwhile, Hahn faces more questions. Of the four Windrose trucks in the U.S., at least two have vehicle identification numbers assigned by Windrose that identify the trucks as having been made in Georgia. The vehicles were made in China, according to Hahn. A representative for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said the agency is seeking additional information from Windrose. Submitting false information could mean a civil penalty of almost $28,000 for each violation. Hahn blamed the VIN issue on a former employee. He said Windrose has been ultra clear about the fact that these trucks came from China and that in the future the trucks would be registered correctly. Meanwhile, Waite, the former driver and technician who Hahn said hasn't helped locate the missing truck, is said he is owed almost $30,000 in back pay. He said Hahn always had an explanation for why wages were delayed and a promise that problems would soon be resolved. I believed in the product, Waite said. I didn't really believe in when. And that's at Tesla truck rival, wages rig go missing. We'll turn now to the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal, financial analysis and commentary, for an item by Jonathan Weil. Strategy is trapped by its crypto math. The Bitcoin hoarder created a bespoke valuation metric that ignores market realities. Strategy, the Bitcoin hoarding company led by Chairman Michael Saylor, is caught in a math trap of its own making. Saylor has trained investors to believe Strategy's model for acquiring Bitcoins would work as long as the market valued the company at a premium to the value of its Bitcoin holdings. Effectively, the company's overvalued stock became a currency to buy Bitcoin. Strategy even created a bespoke metric called MNAV to track the premium. It did so while building a Bitcoin stash worth more than $50 billion, financed with sales of equity and debt securities. The problem that came to a head recently is the metric began showing the market was valuing Strategy at a discount to the value of its Bitcoins. The roll-up strategy was starting to come undone, and roll-ups typically don't work well in reverse. Adding to the strain, the metric is artificially inflated because it ignores sharp declines in the value of some of the company's securities. Although the metric is essentially a made-up measure, it matters for Strategy investors and the cryptocurrency market. By Strategy's own logic, if the metric is at a discount instead of a premium, the company should be selling some Bitcoin to buy back its own securities. Investors are watching warily for any sign that Strategy might start doing so in large numbers. The stakes are high. Strategy's holdings represent 4% of the total Bitcoins that will ever exist. Selling some could drag Bitcoin's already battered price down further, along with Strategy's stock. A small sale by Strategy in May had that effect, even though it sold 32 bitcoins for $2.5 million. On Monday, before the market opened, Strategy disclosed that it sold 3,588 bitcoins last week for $216 million. That's still a fraction of the bitcoin it owns. That's why Strategy investors watch MNAV. So, what is it? Strategy says MNAV shows its enterprise value as a multiple of its Bitcoin holdings, and it used to regularly show a steep premium to its Bitcoin. In its heyday, this allowed Strategy to regularly sell stock to buy more Bitcoin. It acted like a traditional roll-up company, using inflated shares as currency to fund an acquisition spree. For now, that game is over. Strategy stock is down 75% over the past year, and the MNAV has dropped precipitously, falling below 1 last month. That set the stage for Strategy's announcement on June 29th that it would abandon its hold-on-for-dear-life philosophy. It said its board had authorized selling up to $1.25 billion of its Bitcoin to buy back shares and cover interest payments and preferred stock dividends. But Strategy's predicament is worse than it appears. The MNAV metric has a flaw that's grown acute as the prices of Strategy's bonds and preferred shares have tanked along with its stock. To calculate enterprise value, Strategy adds the market value of its common stock to the principal amount of its debt and the par value of its preferred stock, then subtracts cash. Normally, that formula works fine if the debt and preferred shares are trading at or near par. The problem now is that MNAV overstates Strategy's enterprise value, the ratio's numerator, by using the face value of its debt and preferred stock rather than their market value. That makes the metric artificially high. It also defeats the purpose of showing the extent to which the market is valuing Strategy at a premium or discount. On June 26, when Strategy said the MNAV was just under 0.99, it would have been 0.89 using the market value for its debt and preferred stock. For enterprise value, strategy included $6.75 billion of debt and $15.46 billion of preferred stock. Those were par values, not market values. At the time, Strategy's debt was trading at a 7% discount, and its various series of preferred shares combined were trading for a 28% discount. Since then, MNAV has rebounded along with Strategy's share price. As of 4 p.m. Monday, Strategy's website showed MNAV as 1.06, but would have been 1.01 using market values for its debt and preferred stock, which was barely any premium. To staunch the bleeding, Strategy on June 29th raised the dividend on its biggest preferred series called STRC, or Stretch, to 12%. It hoped to lure buyers and lift the price closer to par value. The move revealed that Strategy cares deeply about its preferred shares' market prices, despite not using them in the MNAV metric that it spotlights for investors. Last week, the company estimated its $2.55 billion cash buffer would buy it about a 17-month cushion to pay interest and preferred dividends without selling its crypto. But if the market starts valuing Strategy at a discount again, and it sticks, Strategy faces the prospect of running out of cash and having no choice but to tap its Bitcoin stash in much greater numbers. Strategy might have bought itself some time. There's no telling how much it has left. And that's Strategy is trapped by its crypto math. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal, and remind you, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. And you can get that for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or for your iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.